Good morning. I'm Nancy Williams for the Petals and Prose section of the Zesty Garden. And I want to share some today about seasons in the garden because all of them are, three of them are so wonderful. And then we have winter, which is so important. And we all think, what do we do in winter with the garden besides read up on the seed catalogs? But that's an important part. I'm not going to talk to you today about reading the seed catalogs. I'm just going to talk about some of the things we do in some of the seasons that we really love. It actually ends with winter, so I almost couldn't be truthful in my opening statement. This comes from Gardening at the Dragon's Gate by Wendy Johnson, which if you've been listening long, you know is one of my favorite gardening manuals because it has not just instructions, but great little essays. And this is one of her fun little essays. She writes, "Summer is wild berry season on the California coast, the time when the Green Gulch kids migrate to the edge of the high summer garden to build secret blackberry forts. While the grones, as they call us, work harvesting butter lettuce and the last lavender of the season, Zen rascals guzzle ripe berries deep in the maze of summer. The kids do come up out of their blackberry thicket for high tea in the late afternoon. Hot, dirty, and scratched, and indigo blue with blackberry juice, they are hosed off and served iced lemon verbena tea, afloat with sprigs of black mint and anise hyssop blossoms. The garden crew bribes the kids into coming to tea. If they gather us a few baskets of wild blackberries early in the day, we'll make fruit tarts for tea time. We cajole them. No surprise, they agree. High tea is good at the end of a long day of making forts and living outside of Zen law. We all spoil our appetites for dinner with tiny fruit tarts made from wild blackberries mixed with dead ripe gooseberries and the last white currants of the season. After tea, we lie back in the grass and watch the evening clouds mount in the west, out over the ocean. The hills darken, russet and amber, and all the garden cranberry bean plants sag with the weight of August. The kids' parents are probably worried about where they are, but we are too lazy to move or be mildly responsible. Even when the first owls settle on the dark cypress limbs, we fail to budge. Young and old together, we are sated with full summer. But now that's past. In autumn, the ground is thirsty for rain, and by late October, Redwood Creek has dropped underground. Outside of the garden, the coast live oaks and huge tan oaks of the watershed ripen their acorns. The blue jays collect the first acorns of November, drilling them into the dry ground with their sharp beaks. Watching the jays work, I know it's time to begin my own harvest of acorns from oaks on the lower flanks of Mount Tamalpais that have been harvested for generations by the native Costa Noan tribes of the California Bay Area. As recently as 250 years ago, the Ohlone people who lived in the Redwood Creek watershed were hunter-gatherers who also farmed the land, cultivating the wild oaks. Particular oak trees were in the care of individual family groups for generations, in an era when time itself was linked to the seasons of the oak. The autumn harvest, when tribes came together to celebrate by gleaning, gathering, and preparing food harvested from the oaks, marked the new year. Winter was measured in moon phases from the time of the acorn harvest. Spring was told by the flowering of the oaks, and summer was marked by the progression toward the ripening of the acorn harvest. 10,000 native people inhabited the 150 miles from the San Francisco Bay south to the Esalen Nation of Big Sur. The native people tended their trees faithfully. The first drop of acorns was usually riddled with acorn moth larvae. The Ohlone people covered these wormy acorns with dry grass and set the grass afire, destroying the primary larval phase of the oak pest. Then, when the healthy main season acorn drop occurred in early November, the fruit fell on a clean understory of savanna-like parkland beneath the huge oaks. There's an old story told by the Karuk people of Northern California about how the different species of oak came to earth. In the old days, acorns were sky maidens living in the heavens. Once, when there was famine on the earth, the sky maidens took pity and came down to be food. Valley Oak Girl dove down first, clapping her small gathering basket on her long, slender head. Her sister, Black Oak Maiden, wore her large burden basket, which is to this day her signature acorn cap. Next came tiny Coast Live Oak Girl with her small basket cap. And last of all, wearing her messy, rough burden basket cap, Tan Oak Maiden descended, becoming the richest food of all. Gathering acorns was a favorite autumn practice for my daughter and me for many years. I still gather acorns every autumn, and miraculously, my teenage daughter often helps. We take the acorns home, spread the good ones to dry behind our wood-burning stove. After a few days, we crack the acorns using a prized stone pestle. Though a mallet or hand pruners are equally effective, we pry the acorn meat out of the shell. Every season, we begin pounding the acorn meat by hand, but soon move to a modern food processor that whizzes the remainder of the acorn meat into a golden meal. Acorns are bitter in taste, rich in tannin and oil. Native people leached their acorn meal in slow-running river water to wash away the tannic acid. My modern adaptation is simple. I hang the acorn meal in cheesecloth pouches under a slow-dripping cold water tap overnight. Dark ochre tannin colors our old enamel sink a rich butternut gold every November. After it's leached, the acorn meal is laid to dry on clean towels before I toast it slowly in our oven until the kitchen smells like the inner kernel of the sunny oak forest. I mix the roasted meal with honey and fold in some fresh pumpkin pulp, adding whole wheat flour and a little baking soda to raise the bread. Every season, the acorn bread is a little different, depending on whim and fancy and what is at hand. If you want to do this, I was talking with our host of the Zesty Garden, Brian Earle, about where to find acorns. And I think although we don't have any wonderful live oaks or the other oaks that California does, we could still gather acorns from scrub oak in the mountains, and that might work. I would be willing to try it. If I find an acorn patch, I probably will. The basic ingredients for this, which she calls Thanksgiving acorn pumpkin bread, are 1 cup of whole wheat or white flour, 3/4 cup of acorn meal, 1 teaspoon salt, 1 1/4 cups of brown sugar, 2 teaspoons baking soda, and spices to taste. So that would be cinnamon, nutmeg, mace, whatever is your favorite spicy pumpkin bread spice. And for the wet ingredients, you need 1 cup of pumpkin pulp, which you can take from a can, or you can simply bake a small pumpkin, cut it open and scoop out the seeds and just measure pulp out of that. 1/3 cup of vegetable oil, 1/4 cup of water, and 2 eggs, beaten. You combine the dry ingredients and you mix them together with the wet ingredients and then fold them in together into a well-oiled baking tin. Bake it at 350 for 50 to 60 minutes. And good luck with that. That's what I'd say. It says enjoy at the end, but I'm thinking it might not be to our taste. Not much lost, just a new learning experience. Wendy continues, I do not bake acorn bread on hot slabs of rock as the Ohlone people did. I am a modern kind of native to this earth, baking in a wolf oven as I keep the links to our watershed alive season after season. In early December, when winter unravels the organized garden, I want all work wound up, but winter's skein of ragged tasks lengthens as the days shorten. By the evening of the winter solstice, darkness drops well before 5 p.m., like iron shears cutting the last threads of the lit year. Yet every December, cold, wet soil calls me out of my warm house. I like to climb Coyote Ridge with a small clutch of kids and plant 1-year-old fir and redwood seedlings in the shelter of shadowy north-facing canyons. From here, the willows down in the creek float in a copper haze against the steel-blue coastal range, and the sea and fields are one dark wash of green. When we finally come down from the headlands, we are cold and mean with hunger. We raid the winter garden for abandoned vegetables to make into soup. The forgotten rhubarb chard is still quite tender, its roots running in blood red and tangled underground. At the back of the field, the rain-beaten remnants of my favorite leeks are still wearing clean white silk stockings under their mud-spattered wrapping leaves. We carry our treasures to the Zen Center kitchen and sauté the leeks with red garlic and cook the chard with tender yellow-flecked potatoes in a rich vegetable stock. Next, we puree the steaming winter vegetables into a thick, hearty soup and feast on the bounty of winter. The kids eagerly slurp down every last drop of soup, cleaning their bowls with slabs of freshly baked Norwegian rye bread spread with sweet butter. It's almost dark when we finish this winter feast. We have worked hard, and the headlands are anchored by more than a few hundred new trees this evening. As night falls outside the cold windows, I remember hidden treasure. Reaching into my coat pocket, I pull out a bright green bouquet of fir tips, collected that afternoon from young Douglas firs that we planted two seasons ago. Delight ripples through the throng, a fresh reason to stay together. Water is boiled and the fir tips are tossed into a teapot to steep, for 2 minutes only, into fragrant forest tea, rich in vitamin C. Chocolate chip cookies materialize as if by magic from the locked cookie cabinet that only 13-year-old Davy knows how to open with an unfaltering sleight of hand. Everyone looks the other way as Davy opens the forbidden door. Triumphant, he serves us cookies, while Elisa helps Sabrina pour hot fir-tip tea. We lift our steaming cups to the cold night and warm company. "Love winter," wrote Thomas Merton, "when the plants say nothing, and all the links that bind us to one another, to real food and the sleeping land, are alive and intertwined."